listening to The Loop Podcast, a project in plastic surgery innovation.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Morgan Martin. Welcome back to The Loop Podcast. This is part two of the lymphedema episodes. So if you haven't already, please go back and listen to part one before you listen to this episode. You'll be hearing from our great medical student from Tulane, Magnus Chun, Dr. Kyle Hsu from University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, and Dr. Christopher Homsey from Tufts University School of Medicine. So please enjoy this episode. Again, it's very educational, very in-depth, and great for the upcoming in-service. We just left off with treatment options for lymphedema, and we'll be hearing about immediate lymphatic reconstruction.
So now I want to talk a little bit about immediate lymphatic reconstruction and a specific procedure called lymphatic microsurgical preventive healing approach, or NIMFA, which is, from what I understand, is actually it's just the similar technique as LVA and LVB, as we mentioned. So Dr. Holmesy and I are working on a reveal on the upper and lower extremity lymphedema following extra lymph node dissection with and without immediate lymphatic reconstruction. And we saw that, you know, only 3% of patients develop lymphedema after extra lymph node dissection with immediate lymphatic reconstruction, and that NIMFA was, in fact, the most effective technique. So Dr. Holmesy, can you kind of talk about what immediate lymphatic reconstruction is, what NIMFA is, and how all of this kind of relates back to lymphedema?
Sure. It is first important, very important and critical to define, as you said, what NIMFA is. You know, lymphoma, for the audience who's really not familiar with this, it's spelled, you know, L-Y-M-P-H-A in all caps, and it's an abbreviation of lymphatic. So the first two letters, L-Y, are from lymphatic microsurgical preventative healing approach, and, you know, it becomes an acronym of lymphoma. And really the thought behind lymphoma is that perhaps the best way to manage lymphedema is just to avoid it altogether in the first place. So just like, you know, medicine and preventative medicine is like a big deal in a lot of other specialties. That's why we do colonoscopies to prevent colon cancer. That's why we do, you know, mammograms to kind of catch it early. Same thing. If you think about lymphoma, is just a way of preventing lymphedema before it even happens. And the more commonly used term now is ILR rather than lymphoma per se. And it's ILR is for immediate lymphatic reconstruction. And I think the main advantage of this technique of ILR is its timing rather than technically how it's done. So when lymphoma or ILR is performed, there's usually no previous scar tissue. So the tissues are soft. You're like right there when, for example, they're doing the mastectomy. The tissues are soft. It's what we call virgin territory as compared to coming back to someone who had surgery. There's a lot of scar tissue. You have to go back, remove the entire scar tissue, find adequately sized veins, find your lymphatics, connect those. So that's really why I think the importance of ILR becomes is that you're doing it up front where everything, all the tissue is still soft. And we can talk about like how to do it. You can use the telescoping technique, or you can use, you know, you put like one or two or more lymphatics and you can basically intersuscept them into a vein. Or you can, if there is a huge discrepancy between the vein and the artery, you can do an anastomosis, which is like an end-to-side, or it's an end-to-end if you have good size match. But really, I just think when you talk about lymphoma and why it's more advantageous, I think it's just the concept of doing it upfront before you even have any lymphedema.
We touched on this a little bit already. Dr. Hsu talked about that conservative treatment is always going to be your first line of therapy. But specifically, when do you know surgery is needed? You know, what are some metrics that we're looking at after refractory treatment with conservative therapy?
Yeah, so for my patients, the indications for surgery are three. One is patients that are not improving or have plateaued with non-surgical treatment for at least 6 months. So they have to undergo lymphedema therapy for at least 6 months. And that's also important because after surgery, you have to go back to therapy to optimize the surgery. So I want to make sure that they're already established with a lymphedema therapist. Number two is recurrent cellulitis. So patients who have recurrent infections secondary to their lymphedema will benefit from surgery, because we know that the different surgical procedures that we perform, lymphovenous bypass and vascularized lymph node transplant, can actually decrease the incidence of cellulitis in these patients. And my third indication is improvement in quality of life. You know, remember, you know, as a plastic surgeon, what we do is we do surgeries to improve patients' quality of life. And some patients, as I said before, spend 40 to 70 hours a week managing their lymphedema, or patients have body image issues because with lymphedema, you can't fit into clothes correctly, or you can't wear normal shoes. And these surgeries hopefully can improve their quality of life by decreasing the symptoms, or decreasing the volume of the limb, or improving the function of that limb. And in terms of patient selection, there's a few things that patients have to complete or have before I would offer surgery. One is they have to be compliant with therapy and compression. Number two is my goal BMI is less than 35. So patients have to have a healthy and healthy diets and not be too overweight, because we know that the lymphatic system does not work as well in patients who are overweight. The third thing is they have to have realistic expectations, and they have to understand what is their goal for a successful outcome. Because as we know from these different procedures, not every patient will improve after these lymphatic reconstructive procedures. Studies show that about, I would say, 60 to 70% of patients decrease in volume. And however, more than 90% of patients report improvement in their quality of life. So I just want to make sure that patients have realistic expectations. Most patients will still have to wear compression after these procedures and may have to wear compression for the rest of their life. Only maybe 30 or 40% of patients can wean from their compression. And patients do better if they're treated earlier. So early stage lymphedema do better than later stage lymphedema because they still have functional lymphatics. Patients also have to have a competent venous system. You know, these procedures divert fluid into the venous system. So if they have a venous problem, it's like taking a traffic jam and diverting into another traffic jam. We got to make sure they have a competent venous system. So it's so important to have, I get venous studies on every patient, including a venous reflux study for legs, you know, a DVT study to rule out DVTs. And also I obtain a CT scan to make sure that they don't have venous compression in the central veins in their pelvis or abdomen. And then lastly is they have to be a good surgical candidate, because this is, you know, elective surgery. You know, patients who are have to be healthy enough for these complex procedures, which can take 6 to 8 hours in the operating room. And then the last thing I forgot to mention is active cancer. I only perform these procedures on patients who do not have active cancer and are in remission.
Excellent. I actually wanted to go back to the immediate lymphatic reconstruction point here and talk about differences between NIMFA and vascularized lymph node transfer for lymphedema. Dr. Holmsey, can you kind of describe the differences? And also, you know, when do you actually use liposuction, if at all?
So again, you know, LIMFA and ILR, or immediate lymphatic reconstruction, to me are two descriptives of the same concept, which is a prophylactic reconstruction of the lymphatic system using, you know, LVA, venous anastomosis or bypass. So really LVA and LVB is just an anastomosis or bypass of lymphatics into a vein, just like Dr. Xu elegantly described, of you know moving the traffic from one system to the other. On the other hand, when you talk about vascularized lymph node transfer or transplant, it's just another free flap. You know, it's a free tissue transfer where we harvest the tissue rich in lymph node, whether that's in the supraclave, the neck, the submental, the omentum, the groin. It's just a conglomeration of lymphatic tissue that itself has its own pedicle, an artery and a vein, or artery and, you know, a couple veins. So when you raise this tissue as a flap and you remove it as a free flap, you anastomose it into the recipient vessel, artery, and vein, just like when we do for any free flap, and under the microscope. And, you know, whether this is in the axilla and in cases of upper extremity lymphedema, or in the groin for cases of lower extremity lymphedema, you are basically talking about using this lymph node tissue as, you know, like a pump, as well as, you know, there's thoughts and theories that it might increase the growth factor that promote formation of new lymphatic tissue. So, you know, there are two different physiologic procedures to try to reverse or correct an entity, which is an increase in the lymphatic pressure. When it comes to liposuction, it's a chapter or a subchapter in the big theme of debulking procedure versus what we talked about are the physiologic procedure. So you do liposuction, just like the name implies. So you're suctioning fat when you have fat that you're dealing with and not fluid. So usually you do liposuction as a adjunct to a debulking procedure when you know for a fact that there has been fatty deposition from either like a long-standing lymphedema or someone who basically failed earlier treatments and actually developed into a lipedema phenotype. And this is when liposuction come into play, is where you know that it's too late for you to reverse the clock and fix that so-called the traffic jam. You have to just physically, whether it's a Charles or modified Charles procedure, where like Dr. Xu was explaining, you take your knife and you just excise that tissue, or using liposuction when the fat is soft and you can just using, like anytime we do liposuction, a liposuction cannula, and suctioning that fat to help kind of decrease the circumference of the arm or of the leg. So that's really how I look at it in terms of treatment. So I don't know if that really answers your question, Magnus.
Yeah, no, that's great. That does. It definitely does. And thanks for the breakdown between LIMFA and VONT. Are there any contraindications for immediate lymphatic reconstruction?
For me, the number one contraindication for immediate lymphatic reconstruction is patient's health. We, by doing the procedure at the same time as the cancer surgery, so for example, for breast cancer, it would be a mastectomy or lymphectomy and an axillary lymph node dissection. We do the procedure at the same time. It does add an hour, sometimes an hour and a half, to the procedure. So we have to make sure the patient is healthy enough for the extra general anesthesia. I would say most patients are healthy enough for the procedure, but there are a few patients where we did not offer the procedure because the patient is not healthy enough. And number two is, you know, patients need to be educated about the procedure. And we talk about the risks and benefits of the procedure. And some patients are not interested in undergoing the extra procedure. One thing I do want to say about immediate lymphatic reconstruction is there's no extra incisions for the procedure. You know, you're doing it through the same surgical site, and really the post-operative course is no different than after having a mastectomy and axillary lymph node dissection. And then number two is there's really not enough literature looking at some of the other cancers like melanoma or sarcomas when they undergo a lymph node dissection, whether it's in the groin or in the axilla. There's just not enough literature to support these procedures at this time.
Excellent. Yeah. So, you know, it's important to understand what you just said. That's great. So kind of just briefly, Dr. Holmesy, can you talk about the specific technique of NIMFA, you know, number of anastomosis that we'll have to have, what type of anastomosis, and kind of the duration of NIMFA?
Yeah, so Magnus, you know, whenever we're talking about lymphatic surgery and, you know, manipulating or working on lymphatic vessels, you have to talk about fluorescence lymphangiography. And you can't really do these surgeries if you don't have the technology that helps you visualize these small little lymphatic vessels. So it's really virtually impossible to perform if you don't have a good microscope, good instrument with very, very fine, you know, 10-0, 11-12-0 sutures. And, you know, usually what we use is indocyanine green, ICG, which, you know, the audience may be familiar with when we do like spy angiography to assess the perfusion of like our mastectomy skin flap, for example. So usually when you do these kind of procedures and you have the technology, you start by, you know, injecting ICG, or some other surgeons might inject, you know, isosulfan blue or FITC or fluorescent isothiocyanate. And usually you inject that in the web spaces, second and fourth of the upper extremity, and you wait until the dye goes into the lymphatic system and crawls up the arm until you find your culprit area where the lymphatics are injured, or where you have to perform your anastomosis. So really, the selection of which lymphatic channel to bypass, if more than one are located, is not well defined. It's really a case-by-case scenario. It's not like you have to do one or two or three anastomosis to say, okay, I'm done. So it really depends on the case. But I think on average, you perform anywhere between like one to three or one to four anastomoses. And these anastomoses are done either an end-to-end fashion or an end-to-side fashion. Or as I said, if the vein is very big and you have multiple lymphatic channels that are pretty close to each other, you can just put them like intussuscept them within the vein and basically use a suture to kind of close everything on the outside, just making sure you don't kink or obstruct the lymphatic channel. So it's really a case by case in terms of the technique. And in terms of the duration, again, it could be anywhere from, you know, 1 hour to 3 hours, depending, and again, how much you're doing. If it's an ILR, it's assuming that you don't have a lot of fibrosis and you don't have a lot of injury or damage to the tissue, and hoping sometimes that the breast surgeons, when they did their axillary lymph node dissection, they kind of, you know, looked at a vein that they preserved and protected. So sometimes it's like cheating. Sometimes they help you cut down on the operative time if they know that you will be using this vein to kind of reroute the lymphatic channels into it. So that's, I think, kind of like a quick breakdown of the techniques and the duration.
That's excellent. I want to go ahead and take a step back here and talk about you know, any pre-op procedure. So you know, you touched on this. My understanding is that you use lymphoscintigraphy to look at the patient's lymph node and actually confirm the diagnosis of lymphedema. Is that correct? And can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so lymphoscintigraphy for me right now is still the diagnostic study of choice to diagnose lymphedema. It is still my gold standard study. Every patient who presents to me with limb swelling, I obtain a lymphoscintigraphy to confirm lymphatic dysfunction and to confirm lymphedema. So what a lymphoscintigraphy does is you inject a radial tracer in the web space, whether it's in the hand or the foot, and you follow this radial tracer through the lymphatic system to the lymph nodes. So for example, in the leg, you would inject it into the web space of the foot, and then you would get multiple x-rays at different time points to see how long it will take to get to the groin lymph nodes. So it's like taking a car, tagging it, and see if it gets from point A to point B. But if it doesn't get from point A to point B, you don't really, the study doesn't really give you information on where exactly is the blockage. You know, is it where along the highway is the traffic jam? And that's where ICG lymphography comes into play. ICG lymphography is a procedure that we can perform in the clinic or in the operating room that actually gives you almost like a GPS system of where the lymphatics are. Are they functioning? And where is the traffic jam? However, the limitation of ICG lymphography is the camera can only look about 1 to 2 centimeters deep. So it doesn't really look at the deep lymphatic systems. Another issue with ICG lymphography is if patients have a lot of backflow, it kind of clouds up the picture. So there could be lymphatics hidden underneath that we can't see because the fluid is blocking our view. You get a complete whiteout and it blocks the view. So now there are new imaging techniques such as high frequency ultrasound. That is the future, where you take an ultrasound probe and you can actually see the lymphatics within the tissue with an ultrasound machine.
Great, that's excellent. We talked about pre-op, so now let's talk about post-op. What can patients expect post-operatively, and are there any common post-operative complications?
Yeah, so, you know, as Dr. Shu alluded to earlier, this kind of surgery is really great for patients because it changes and improves their quality of life. They might not be perfect, and we're not telling the patient that we're going to cure your lymphedema. But when you tell the patient and when they see that after you did the surgery, their limb circumference is now half or even like it's a 40% improvement, to them, that translates to an improve in their activity of daily living. They can, like Dr. Shu said, they can maybe drive their car. They feel less heaviness in their arms. So, you know, it's very important to look at outcomes from a patient standpoint. And that's why now you see a lot of the studies and a lot of surgical subspecialty are like patient reported outcomes or PROMs. So overall, I think the studies are showing that surgical management of lymphedema is promising with improved quality of life, as we discussed today. And to talk about, you know, post-operatively and what we tell the patient for, you know, immediate lymphatic reconstruction, as we said earlier, these patients are getting the index surgery of cancer extirpation and lymph node sampling or lymphatic lymph node dissection through a incision that we are using to do our work. So you're not adding a comorbidity of a surgical site. So then what becomes the post-operative instructions are the same post-operative instruction that any patient who undergoes, for example, a mastectomy and sentinel lymph node biopsy get. The only thing that we can add is, you know, avoiding abduction of their upper extremity, for example, to more than 90 degrees for a couple weeks. Sometimes, you know, when the general surgeons want to put a JP drain with negative suction into the surgical field, you can redirect where the drain is, just like some modification, just to avoid, you know, disrupting your very fine anastomosis. And then I think the most important thing, as we talked about, is compression, compression, compression. So doing the surgery does not mean that compression is now, you know, it's over. So you have them stop compression for maybe 4 weeks, but then they have to understand that it's a lifetime work of dedication and compliance, even with the surgery, to continue doing some form of compression and working with those certified lymphatic therapist. In terms of complication, it really depends on the surgery. So for example, you know, LVAs or lymphovenous anastomosis, you know, same for vascularized lymph node transplant, you can get delayed wound healing, cellulitis, lymphoceles, lymph leakage, and, you know, sometimes your surgery fails and you don't have any improvement of the lymphedema. For the vascularized lymph node transplant, because you're doing a true arterial and a true venous anastomosis, you might have an anastomotic vascular compromise, which means the free flap will fail. And then you might have, as Dr. Xu talked about, if you take a groin or inguinal lymph nodes and you place them into the axilla, you might risk a donor site morbidity and lower limb lymphedema. So a lot of surgeons, we try to take it from the omentum or from like the neck, as Dr. Xu talked about, because these are statistically less prone to cause donor site lymphedema.
That's excellent. Thank you for that. I know our listeners, our residents, and the faculty that are listening to this episode will be very pleased to hear that and to learn from that. So I want to go ahead and, you know, change gears a little bit here and talk a little bit about history. For the history buffs out there, Dr. Xu, can you tell us a little bit about the history of lymphedema and where you know, we are on the timeline in terms of mastery of treating lymphedema?
Sure. I'll highlight some big achievements in lymphatic reconstruction. So in the early 1900s, the only procedures that we were able to offer was radical excisional procedures, which we know as the Charles procedure. So the Charles procedure, as we discussed earlier, has been attributed to Sir Charles, who was a surgeon. And the interesting thing is it's incorrectly given credit to Sir Charles. He actually did not come up with the Charles procedure as we know it today, which is for the treatment of leg lymphedema. So Sir Charles was a surgeon born in Ireland, and he wound up becoming a surgeon while he was in India during the British occupation. And he saw a lot of patients there with scrotal lymphedema after filariasis, the parasite that causes lymphedema. And he, in 1901, he published his technique and series of 140 patients treated for scrotal lymphedema by excising the tissue and reconstructing the scrotum with flaps from the thigh, meaning taking tissue from the thigh and moving it to close the wound, and then skin grafting the penis. So he actually described the procedure for penile scrotal lymphedema, not for the leg. He actually never successfully described the procedure for the leg. The procedure was described by a physician, Dr. Macy, from the Mayo Clinic. So really what we know as the Charles procedure today for the leg should be called the Macy procedure, but has been incorrectly given credit to Sir Charles. And it's just carried on in our literature as an eponym that we use. Later on in the 1960s, there was a surgeon Goldsmith who published the omental transposition in chronic lymphedema. And then in 1969, Dr. Yamada first published the first clinical case of lymphovenous bypass procedure. He was doing these procedures in a dog model, and the first case he published was in 1969 in humans. And then in 1982, Dr. Clodius published a paper on the pedicle and free vascularized groin lymph node transfer or transplant, where we take lymph nodes from the groin and transplant it to the lymphedema's extremity. And I think really over the last 10 and 15 years, there has been a significantly exponential rise in the literature on different surgical options for lymphedema. And I think there's two reasons for that. One was the development of, or the description of using indocyanine green or ICG lymphography, which gives us a GPS system looking at the lymphatics. That was described by Dr. Ogata in 2007. So we're able to stage lymphedema using this imaging technique and also see where the functional lymphatics are and perform these different procedures with almost like a GPS system. And then in 2010, Dr. Koshima, a very prominent microsurgeon that we all know as microsurgeons, applied the use of what's called super microsurgery for lymphedema. He already described super microsurgery for other flaps, but this is the first time he described super microsurgery for lymphedema. What super microsurgery is connecting blood vessels less than 0.8 millimeters. So if you had to compare this, you know, vascular surgeons are, you know, usually doing these different bypasses procedures for vessels that are in the range of, 3 or 4 or even 5 or 6 millimeters. Microsurgery involves vessels that are in the range of 2 to 3 millimeters, but super microsurgery is when it's less than millimeter, less than 0.8 millimeters. And that requires special tools and high power microscopes. And then in 2014, Bacardo and the Campisi group from Italy published their results on the immediate lymphatic reconstruction, or LYMPHA, for the prevention of lymphedema. And since then, there has been so many new papers and studies looking at these different procedures, how to combine them, what are the best procedures, who should get these procedures, where should we harvest the lymph nodes, what is the best configuration for the bypass procedures. That has been coming out for the last 10 years, and I'm really excited to see what we will come up with in the next 10 or 15 years for treatment or even prevention of lymphedema.
That's awesome. I'm really glad that, you know, this field has been advancing this far so far. You know, the audience here on the new podcast are current plastic surgeons, plastic surgery trainees, and future plastic surgeons and medical students. You know, what should they suspect if they see a patient or if they have a patient of theirs that have lymphedema?
So, you know, when you are faced with a lymphedema patient, I think the first step is to make the correct diagnosis. Like we say in surgery, trust but verify, or never assume. So, you know, we have a nice collegial relationship with other specialties, but you need to confirm yourself that this is actually the right diagnosis of lymphedema. And we talked about how, you know, what tools we use and how to do that based on clinical exam and based on imaging. Next, the second step becomes to educate the patient of what lymphedema is. Again, to stress on what we talked about earlier, education is really, really paramount to patients, to physicians of other specialties, and to the healthcare system in general, because you need to have this patient completely immersed and completely compliant with their own condition and the treatment of their condition, because I don't think you can treat lymphedema in a patient that doesn't really feel that they are part of the treatment team. Like, he's the patient or they're the patient, but they're also part of the team that's helping us help them treat lymphedema. So patient compliance is very important, especially when it comes to the compression and the complete decongestive therapy, because this is when, you know, patients are really, you know, trusted to do compression for like 23 or 24 hours every single day. And as you can imagine, it becomes a little nerve-wracking, a little bit, you know, anxiety-provoking to, like, you know, you have to be compressed at all times. You can't really go out, like, in shorts or in short sleeves sometimes, and you just don't want people to know that you have lymphedema, etc. So it's really the quality of life. These are little things we don't think about. It's really important for these patients. So it's important to educate them on what they're going to be facing, the fact that surgery is not the only, but it's only one facet of the multidisciplinary approach of lymphedema. Weight loss, because as I said, obesity is a risk factor. So if the patient has a body mass index of 40 or 38, they need to understand that no matter what we do, if they don't lose weight and maybe drop their BMI to the 30, low 30 range, that really everything we do might not work. And then I think in general, if you are a plastic surgeon who are seeing this in your clinic and you don't have the capacity to treat this patient in a multidisciplinary team, as I said, I think it's the safest thing to refer these patients to these lymphatic or lymphedema centers or clinics where they would be appropriately educated, accurately diagnosed and measured, imaged, staged, and then offered the appropriate sequence of treatment, which is a multimodal therapy, starting with compression and complete decongestant therapy all the way up to surgery when it's indicated.
So now for our final question here, what do you think is the future of, you know, future outlook of lymphedema? And what are some advances in clinical research on this topic?
If I had to break up lymphedema into three things, I would say number one is prevention. Like Dr. Holmesy was saying, the most important thing we can do is prevent lymphedema from even beginning. This is for secondary lymphedema. Number two is early screening. So catching patients early so that you can treat them appropriately early, because we know that early treatment equals better results. And then the third arm is treatments to address patients with lymphedema or chronic lymphedema. So for prevention, we know about the immediate lymphatic reconstruction or LYMPHA. The questions are, you know, does it work? There's still only a scarcity of studies that actually look at LYMPHA or immediate lymphatic reconstruction. However, there's a lot of new studies ongoing trying to see if LYMPHA actually works and what other cancers can we offer immediate lymphatic reconstruction? Can we offer to patients with melanoma? I know there's ongoing studies looking at melanoma, whether it's safe to offer these procedures in patients with melanoma. And then the second question is, why do only some patients develop lymphedema? You know, one out of three patients after breast cancer and axillary lymph node dissection surgery develop lymphedema. What about the other two thirds? How come they don't develop lymphedema? What are the risk factors for the patients that do develop lymphedema? Why are the patients that don't develop lymphedema, you know, what is it? Is it because they have collateral lymphatics that are able to go around the site of damage? Or is it the surgical technique that was offered to the patient for the axillary lymph node dissection? These are questions that we want to answer so that we can figure out how to prevent lymphedema from the first place. Number two is early screening. You know, we want to catch lymphedema early on, just like diabetes. If you can catch it early and treat it appropriately, you can prevent all the different complications or end-stage diabetes, things like heart disease or wounds on their legs or other vascular diseases like heart attacks. So if we can screen patients early on, we can catch it early and offer them treatment early. So what we're doing here at University of Miami and also a lot of centers is we have a tool called bioimpedance. It's basically a machine that measures fluid by sending a very it's a painless electric shock through the body, and it's able to measure the impedance to tissue. So we know that electricity will move quicker through fluid than through tissue. So we're able to actually catch lymphedema early on, so that we can send them to therapy before the lymphedema progresses. And then the third thing is treatment. There's so many new treatments coming out. For example, there's multiple studies at Stanford and University of Chicago looking at a collagen scaffold called BioBridge. It's an off-the-shelf scaffold that is theorized to help direct lymphogenesis around the area of blockage. It's almost like providing new roads around the area of blockage and to direct the traffic around the actual area of injury. There's also a lot of growth factors being looked at, like vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF, and somehow using that to stimulate new lymphatic regeneration. Other things are looking at anti-inflammatories, because we know that inflammation leads to the fat and fibrosis that we get with lymphedema later on. So is there other inflammatory medications that can decrease inflammation and prevent the progression of lymphedema? Other things are robotic super microsurgery, because super microsurgery requires very fine movements using very specialized instruments. If we can use a robot, that could possibly decrease tremor and improve our blood vessel connections in these tiny little vessels. And then, as I spoke about before, there's a lot of new imaging techniques such as ultra high frequency ultrasound, so that you can actually see the lymphatic vessels in the tissues and determine whether they're functioning and if they're good enough to perform these different procedures. And that has allowed us to perform lymphovenous bypass, which we thought was only reserved for early stage lymphedema, but there are studies showing that it can even perform in later stage lymphedema with good success.
Wow, that's awesome. You know, I'm really, you know, excited and looking forward to see what the future outlook of lymphedema really is. So before we end this episode, I want to go over some of the take-home points. I know we talked about a lot of different topics today. So lymphedema is a common post-operative complication of patients undergoing treatment for breast cancer. The first 9 treatment for lymphedema is conservative, such as compression, exercising, diet, weight loss, and seeing a lymphedema therapist. And for any refractory cases, you would treat with surgery, such as physiologic versus excisional, as Dr. Hsu mentioned. And then finally, we want to increase awareness of lymphedema and to continue increasing lymphedema clinics and centers across the world. Anything else that you both would like to add to that?
I think that lymphedema should become a standard topic in all plastic surgery residencies. And I think it's becoming now more and more kind of streamlined. But just like we cannot really graduate from residency without a full understanding of, you know, what a skin graft is and how to do it and what a flap is and how you treat burns, etc. I think it's safe to say that in 2021, if you're a plastic surgery resident and you will go out in the world and become a plastic surgeon, you should have at least a basic solid understanding of what lymphedema is, its pathophysiology, and its general treatment modalities. And because I think this is the future. Do you agree, Dr. Hsu?
Yeah, Dr. Holmesy, I totally agree. Education is the most important part for lymphedema. We need to educate our medical students and our patients and our communities about lymphedema. In addition, I think lymphatic medicine is going to be its own just entity in the future. Just like we have cardiovascular medicine, I think lymphatic medicine and lymphatic diseases will be a large topic, hopefully in medical schools in the future.
All right. Well, that's it. Thanks, Dr. Hsu and Dr. Holmesy, for helping me with this awesome episode. I'm sure it will be very valuable to our listeners learning about lymphedema.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Magnus.
All right, that is the end of part 2 of Lymphedema. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Again, special thanks to our guest today, who did an excellent job of diving really deep into lymphedema. And again, I learned a ton from this episode. I hope you did too. If you haven't already, make sure and follow us on Instagram to get in the loop.